for the Oregon State Legislature is Friday, March 9th. Today we're going to have a public hearing on three bills and possible work session on two of those. But first we're going to have a public hearing on House Bill 2672. And Representative Witt, I believe you're first up. And Steve, would you give us a little preview of this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2672 prohibits telecommunications utilities from charging customers for service after service is canceled.
Representative Witt, nice to see you on this wonderful Friday afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm glad to see that there are other people still left in the building doing the public's work. Mr. Chairman, committee members, House Bill 2672 is a...
And
is
although I did identify you, maybe you should identify yourself.
Thank you,
yourself.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Brad Witt, House District 31. House Bill 2672 is a very simple bill. In essence, what it says is that with respect to your telephone service, you don't have to pay for that which you choose not to purchase. The genesis of this bill was something that occurred to me personally, and I have since learned that it's a problem for the rest of the citizenry, and I wrote a bill to try and cure that problem. I had changed prior to my coming down to the legislature this year my telephone carrier, and I did that in the very early part of the month. I think it was like about the third of the month. My next telephone bill that I received was for a full month. So I called my carrier at that point and asked to have that issue addressed. First person on the telephone said that it was beyond her capacity to be able to help me. There was nothing that she could do. I was then referred to her supervisor, who told me the same thing, and finally to her supervisor. My telephone call lasted over an hour and a half, and my very last words to the customer service folks was, "Now, I understand you've told me that there's nothing that you can do to assist me with this, but I just want to make absolutely certain, once again, that there is nothing that you can do to assist me in this problem." And I was told that, yes, that was correct. So what this bill does is it says that you will not be charged for service that you do not receive, and that your service must be canceled within 2 days of your request of that doing so, and that if your service is terminated, your bill will be prorated for that portion of the month in which you received a service. I am going to have to request amendments for this bill. When it was drafted, it speaks to telecommunications utility, and I understand that the correct verbiage is telecommunications carrier, so I will be requesting that amendment. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to try and answer any questions that the committee might have.
Representative Riley has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I wanted to know if it's going to affect me. I just received a phone bill for the month of February after having canceled the service at the end of January, and I haven't gotten back to my call right after this committee. So I'm just curious if you think this is going to affect me.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, I don't think the bill is retroactive. So.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Witt, thank you for being here. I have a question about your lengthy phone conversation that you had with the customer service people and managers. Was there any explanation given to you about why you were paying the bill for the balance of the month after you had quit service? Was it because they couldn't figure it out, or because they told you in advance you were going to have to pay that, or what was their explanation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bonamici, yes, the information that I was provided was that is their normal billing cycle. That is the unit in which they provide services on a monthly basis.
Thank you.
Representative Girard.
Thank you, Chair Olvey. Chair Witt, Representative Witt, the question I would have is on, so does this apply to cell phone carriers? And if it did, you know, there's a lot of those long-term contracts that we have with cell phones, and I don't think we want to get into that with this bill. And so we might have to have some type of exclusion language when you're doing the amendment. Would you think that might be appropriate?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Girard, that certainly was not the intent, and I have to confess that I'm not sure of the distinction between even utility and carrier at this point, but you address a good point, and it's something that I will look into, and I will tell you that it was not the intent to include cell phone carriers. If this verbiage does include them, then I would be more than happy to exclude them.
Sure. Representative Gilliam, question?
Yes, thank you, Chairman Holby, and thank you, Representative Witt, for being here. I appreciate Representative Riley's question, because I thought I was going to have to declare a conflict of interest as well. But since it's not retroactive, I stopped calling after a while because I can't get mine sorted out. Nonetheless, what do you say to the other side or to the argument that, technically speaking, this is either in place or, have to forgive me, I can't think of who regulates this, the Public Utilities Commission?
Yeah.
Has the power to do this. I mean, shining a light on it never hurts anything, but your comments on that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gilliam, I certainly would not have a problem with anyone regulating this. Unfortunately, no one has to date, and I'm at the point where I feel that a significant disservice is being done to the public by carriers that charge on a monthly unit basis. Thank you.
Further questions from the committee of the representative?
Well, thank you, Representative Witt, for bringing this issue forward, and I'm sure we're going to hear from some others testifying on this, and we'll endeavor to figure out what the rules and laws are regarding this and what our ability is to address this situation, if in fact that's what our committee chooses to do. Really appreciate you bringing it forward.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. You have a good weekend.
Thank you. You
too. Committee members, love us. Next up, Brant Wolf, and maybe Gene Ang. And I have Judy Pepler, and she's willing to come forward as well.
Yes, thank you.
I have a hard time reading people's names, and I should study those before you come.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brant Wolf, representing the Oregon Telecommunications Association. I've got some written testimony that I've handed out that you should have in front of you, and I'll just briefly kind of hit the high points. We're opposed to this bill. We think it's unnecessary because, in fact, the situation that's being contemplated here, which is disconnecting your service, whether voluntarily or involuntarily, is covered by the Oregon Administrative Rules I've cited in my written testimony there. And really, that's it. That's the long and the short of it. We don't charge customers for services they don't receive. We cannot do that, and we wouldn't do it even if we could. And beyond that, if the bill does move forward, and we don't support it, but if it does, there are a couple of things that need to be clarified. For example, we do need to define telecommunications service. That's not defined as to what that is, whether it's dial tone or just exactly what we're talking about here. And then as far as 2 days, we would prefer 2 business days if it were to come to pass. And I guess it's just that simple. As you can see also, I did a little poll of my members. I mean, we already adhere to what the bill is proposing. I mean, it didn't cause that big of a stir to us. We just think it's kind of redundant and unnecessary. So we would prefer to, if there is a problem, then we would prefer to fix it at the Public Utility Commission and change the rules to, you know, cover whatever needs to be covered. We just don't think this needs to be in statute. And that's the end of my testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Gene Ng, and I'm here on behalf of Verizon. And I just want to echo the comments made by Mr. Wolf and just indicate that we as Verizon, we prorate. If a customer requests termination of service during the month, we will prorate the bill such that the customer is only billed for the services that they receive. So having said that, I would agree with Mr. Wolf that the commission already has the authority under the Oregon Administrative Rules to take care of any problems that might exist. And in addition to that, they also have an established complaint procedure that gives them the latitude to fully address any concerns that a customer who believes that they are being charged incorrectly, you know, gives them that vehicle to take care of, and they have the staff that they can handle that. So, and so having said that, we don't believe that the bill is necessary, and so we stand in opposition. So that's the end of my testimony. Thank you.
Chairman Halvey, members of the committee, I'm Judy Pepler. I'm the Oregon president for Quest Communications. And we also oppose the bill as written for the same reasons that my colleagues here indicated. We believe that the Oregon Public Utilities Commission has an adequate rules and oversight in place to deal with these issues. And if a customer is not satisfied with the response that they get from the company, which obviously Representative Witt was not and shouldn't have been, there is a process, a complaint process through the Public Utilities Commission that they can utilize. Hopefully they'd get a better response from the company, and if it was my company, I would apologize and certainly would want to work with the representative to address his issue. There's also a number of other problems with the bill as written. We're a company that provides billing services for third parties, and so even if you disconnect your service on a certain day, we may get a tape from, you know, say another long-distance provider that we bill for or another service provider that we would then have to put on a final bill, so that would show up after the disconnect date, but it would still be for services that were rendered by that company. There's no accommodation in the bill as written for that. The bill also requires a disconnection of service in 2 days' time. Some of our services do have a minimum commitment time, as the representative noted on wireless, but on wireline services as well. A lot of times you're committing to a certain contract length to get the price that we're offering, or that you're agreeing to a certain minimum commitment time in order to get the special. There's no accommodation in the bill as written for those circumstances. And we also have a number of products and services, because telecommunications service isn't defined in the bill, that we just virtually could not disconnect in 2 days. And we do prorate, as Verizon does, all of our services. So we may not be able to disconnect it in 2 days. It may be a service that's on a contract that we wouldn't agree to disconnect. And so there are a number of problems with the bill as it's written, and we, again, would echo my colleagues that we believe that there's adequate protection, oversight, and process in place at the Public Utilities Commission at this time to address this, so this bill is not necessary, and we would oppose it. Thank you.
Questions from the committee? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And any of you can answer this. It doesn't matter to me. I didn't look at the OIR that Mr. Wolf cited. You say that it applies, but does it have a specific period of time in which you can't bill after a certain period of time of cancellation? And also, does it say somewhere expressly that you can't bill for services after cancellation?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, I did look at the rules before I came over here. I wouldn't want to quote from memory, but I can assure you that if you're a customer and you call to cancel your service, once that occurs, it's over. It's done at that point. And the language is pretty clear there that you're not going to be charged for service that you don't get. If it's a regulated service, as my colleagues have indicated, if it's some kind of a contract basis or something like that, then obviously that's not going to be covered by the rules. But for the regulated telecommunication services, it's really clear that you won't be charged for service you don't receive.
Thank you.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Eng. I'm glad you're here. I'm interested in this bill because in my particular case, I just got a bill for a month after I canceled, or at least thought I canceled. Apparently, the company doesn't think I did. This bill apparently won't cover that because, as you're saying, you will be billed after your service is canceled. Your company happens to have an automated phone answering service that says, just do this and your service will be canceled. So I never talked to an operator. I never talked to a real person, but only to an automated service that said, your service is canceled as of now. And apparently it wasn't. So what's going to happen?
I'm actually quite surprised that that occurred, because typically what happens is, even if you use that automated process, and then the date that it should have been canceled, even if it takes us a day or two to actually physically disconnect the service, we will only bill to the day that the customer requested that the service be canceled.
Right.
So I'd be happy to look into your particular situation, but
wait until I make the phone call. I haven't called him yet.
Okay.
Chairman Holby, if I could make one other comment. We bill a month behind, so you might get a bill for service that looks like they didn't cancel the service, but it should only bill to the date that you disconnect, and it may just be in behind. I mean, those are situations as well, as that we do a final bill, and we usually disclose that when we take the disconnect order. So,
Representative Gerard.
Yeah, you mentioned that you can file a complaint with the Oregon Utilities Commission. What is the process that they undergo? Like, if they take one of these complaints and they find that Mr. Witt over here was correct in what he was saying, what happens to the carrier?
Mr. Chair, Representative, what the process is they take the complaint on an informal basis at the Public Utilities Commission. If the customer has not been satisfied with the service that they got from the company, they then have a contact in my company, and I know it's the same in the others, where we have a complaint group that works directly with the Public Utilities Commission. That complaint group would then look at the account. They would look at what the situation is, what the representative said, what the service rep did, and then they would make the appropriate determination on what happened. If they needed to credit the bill, they would do that. They report all of that finding back to the Public Utilities Commission. The Public Utilities Commission will look at that. We'll see whether it seems reasonable. We'll work with the customer. If the customer is still not satisfied, they have a formal procedure that they can go through to file a formal complaint, and that will be adjudicated by an ALJ, and a final order will be entered into. So it's quite an extensive process, and 99% of them we handle on a very informal basis. They typically do not go to a formal complaint.
Further questions from the committee? Well, I guess
you know, I'm looking at this, and you're saying that this bill is already covered in rules specifically, but and maybe I missed it. But as far as the two business days, how long does it take to disconnect somebody's service? If, when they call up, you say that as soon as you tell them it's canceled, it's canceled. So it would seem like there would be no charges at all from that point forward. But in your testimony, you're also saying that that 2 days is too quick. You can't really disconnect everything in 2 days. So I'm trying to pull all that together. It's canceled, but you're still charging after it's canceled because you can't turn something off within 2 days. Can you elaborate on that just a little bit for me?
Sure, Chair Holby. I may have misspoke. What my point on the 2 days is, you know, sometimes you need two business days, but regardless, the day that they do the cancellation is the day that the billing stops. But there are some situations where you've entered into a minimum commitment or you've entered into a contract, and so the 2 days, you know, under this bill would apply, but they shouldn't apply because the customer has agreed to a minimum amount of commitment is what I'm saying. It may very well be that we don't get the service turned off or disconnected for longer than that, but the billing will stop as of the disconnect date that we give you.
Right, Mr. Chair, that's my written testimony there, and it was to kind of get at a late Friday afternoon phone call or something like that. I mean, I think it's just a reasonable ask, quite frankly. It's two business days. I can't imagine a scenario where, speaking on behalf of smaller companies, it would ever take 2 days to disconnect your service, but we just thought that was reasonable.
Well, it just concerns me because now I've got two representatives in the room that have both had this seemingly the same, three now in this room that have had the same problem with phone companies and disconnecting their service and getting billed beyond the time they canceled. And, you know, so, and you're saying this is done in rule. I guess I'm going to have to call the PUC up and wonder why we have evidently a pretty widespread problem, just judging from the population here at the dais. And if it's already in rule, you're just objecting to having that rule codified in statute for, I guess if it's already in rule, what's the problem with putting it into statute, I guess? Other, if it was cleared up that it didn't cover the contracted, cell phones and, some of those other long-term contracted uses.
I guess if I could respond, Mr. Chair, from my perspective, the administrative rule process is much more flexible and easier to work in, no offense, than the legislative process. And we just prefer for these kinds of things to be in rule and not in law. It's just a lot easier to fix problems if there's language or some technical problem. You know, you don't have to wait to get it done. You can start the process sooner. And that goes both ways, for consumers and for the industry. And we just prefer for it to be in the rule.
Well, just I guess to follow up on that myself, I have a lot of respect for our rules as well. But when the rules don't seem to get the job done, then, the next step is to put it into statute to make it, to make it happen. Because evidently it's, this rule is evidently not being followed very closely by the industry from, I'm just judging from the three out of the, four? No.
I want to answer the question.
I'm just kind of curious why, when people call up and cancel, they're continuing to get bills for time after their cancellation dates. I guess I'm just not understanding why that continues to happen, and then the customer then is forced to go through this cumbersome process of appeals with the PUC, and as you said, it's a pretty lengthy process just to get through that point, and it's sometimes hard to get a telephone person to answer the phone when you call their office to talk to them about it. So I'm kind of at a loss as to what the problem and what the solution is here.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, I went through the process. It doesn't have to be lengthy. If quite frankly, I'd love to find the specifics of his situation, because usually if you talk to a supervisor at any of our companies, it would get resolved right at that level. If it doesn't, a phone call to the Public Utilities Commission and put it into our specialized complaint handling is really, I mean, we turn those around within days because we have a specialized group that deals with those. So it seems like a widespread problem right here, but really if you looked at the total number of complaints, total number of issues that have come before our company, and I think Verizon's probably in the same situation, it's a very small number of overall complaints in total. And again, I think the rules are already in place at the Public Utilities Commission, or they at least have the ability and the authority to do something about it if there's a problem.
And I'm just going to make one other thing. I mean, I appreciate that, but what sort of bothers me a little bit is perhaps if this is a practice, you know, in the industry to continue to bill people after the cancellation dates, how many of those people just pay because they figure the phone company's right and they need to move on? And you know, so I mean, I think you may have a considerable amount of population, judging again from the problem that's been exhibited here, that you're collecting money that you shouldn't be. And so, I mean, just that business practice of billing people after a cancellation date for service that they didn't get, and you say that you don't do that, but the bill goes out, mm-hmm. and some people are likely to pay that. So, I guess I'm just a little concerned about that. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask the three industry representatives here if, as part of your consumer complaint process within your companies, does that include some sort of notification or information to the consumer that they have the right to go to the PUC?
Chair Hovey, Representative Bonamici, yes, it does.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, ours is too. I think typically it's on the bill. It's printed on the bill that if you have concerns and it can't be addressed, you can always go to the Public Utilities Commission.
And just one other comment, Chair Holby. It has not been our experience that customers pay the bill if they don't think they owe it. We typically get the phone call right away if they think that they've been billed in error.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, to answer your question, I represent a lot of different small companies, and I don't know that they all state that on their bill clearly, but, you know, these are companies that if you have a problem like this, you would just walk down the street and throttle somebody at the business office before you went to the Public Utility Commission, frankly. That's probably the way that would work. Although I think if it ever got to a point where there was a problem like that, it would be made clear that they can go to the commission if they wanted to.
Thank you. Brief follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up, please.
Thank you. I'd like to ask the victimized representatives in our room if any of them contacted the PUC as part of their attempts to resolve this issue.
I'm not to that point yet.
Okay.
Immediately following this hearing.
I have not. Any other questions from the committee? Bill, thank you for your testimony today. Appreciate it. And an interest in having the PUC come forward and if they're so willing to enlighten us on this rule and why it doesn't work. Or theoretically doesn't work.
Allegedly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rick Willis. I'm Executive Director of the Public Utility Commission. I'm not sure that it doesn't work. We have very few calls on this issue, and those that we've had are resolved very quickly. Wasn't aware of Representative Witt's concern. One of the things, obviously, for us to address it, someone needs to call us and tell us. But when they have, we've worked with the companies, and generally speaking, it's resolved very quickly.
Questions? Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Chair Holley. What happens if you have a habitual offender that's phone company that is doing all the bad things. You know, they just press everything to the limit, but not quite over where you would suspend any licensure that they have. What do you do with people that the complaints are far higher than all within the industry?
Chair Hovey, Representative, there's a couple of options. One, we can put them on the equivalent of a work plan, if you will, and that is ask them to come in, say, quarterly, and report to us exactly what steps they're taking to correct the problem. In extreme circumstances, we could actually fine the company. But usually going through the process of working with them and identifying the problem, asking them to correct it, asking them to come back and report to us on a regular basis, generally takes care of the problem.
Representative Riley?
Very quickly, comment, please. It's clear to me, at least, that the real problem is that people don't know how to get their problem resolved. And I'm not sure this bill will help that, but I think that that's part of the issue. And again, I'm not sure what will happen with this bill more than what is happening now, because we still have to have them call somebody to let them know that there's a problem. So maybe the solution is to ask the industry to make it more prominent that they have this recourse.
So I'm just kind of perplexed still about this. If in fact you say you don't get very many complaints on this issue, I'm wondering whether people know to complain to you to start with. And two, it's concerning to me because we've just identified three representatives in here that have had this problem where they've been billed after they've canceled their service. It seems like sort of a pervasive practice, perhaps, of billing after cancellation. So how do the rules? Do the rules say that after somebody cancels, you don't charge them anymore? Or I'm just kind of wondering how do we get a grasp on this? Because I kind of feel like if we just leave the rules the way they are and don't take any action whatsoever, that, you know, there's really nothing's really going to change. And so it is concerning to me that we still have this problem, evidently, you know, that people are getting charged after they've canceled their service, and whether or not they get that solved through the particular carrier. Evidently, Representative Witt, you know, who wasn't able to get a satisfaction out of his carrier. And I'd be kind of curious to know if they informed him that he can complain to the PUC. I'm wondering, what do you think the PUC would recommend to deal with this, you know, this apparent problem that you don't get any complaints on?
Mr. Chair, and I don't want to say we don't get any complaints. We do get some. But again, those complaints that we get, especially with the major carriers, are resolved very quickly. Majority of the complaints that we've gotten, at least in the past, have been related to cell phones carriers, which I don't believe is addressed in this bill, and I don't know if that's the intent. As far as what could be done, I think most of the companies do put at the bottom of their bill or someplace on the bill that if you have a complaint that you can't resolve with the company, contact PUC and our telephone number. Trying to work this through, it could be one of the things you could ask is that it be placed more prominently up front. That's a possibility. Obviously, we're in a position that we can only deal with those complaints that we know about. We get them, we deal with them. And in fairness, the companies are very responsive when we call them on this issue. Give them a call and tell them that a customer gave us a call. They virtually always take care of it. So it is more of a problem of notification, of folks being aware that they can give us a call and address it. So, you know, that is one possibility, is to write on the bill, have it placed more prominently.
And I've got one final question just to clarify the two-day issue. When somebody cancels, is there anything in your rule that gives them a certain amount of days before they actually have to cancel and stop the billing?
Mr. Chair, it's handled both in rule and in tariffs, and the tariffs are different for the different companies. But generally speaking, I think it is around 2 days.
Okay. Representative Gilliam, question?
Thank you, Chairman Hovey. I am encouraged by what you're saying, and I appreciate you coming today. And I would urge you to use all those, because of our, I know it's an unscientific poll, but because there are people in the room that have been affected, to use those measures that you have. I appreciate this legislation coming forward. If it, as I said, shines a light on this and pushes everybody to work a little harder on what already exists. In my case, the company shall remain unnamed. But in my case, it started with canceling. You know, I canceled my phone service and I canceled my high-speed internet. And so it was difficult to get the first bill stopped, and it has been impossible to get the second one stopped. And I have had numerous conversations, and I've waited on hold, and all of this sounds very familiar from my colleagues. And it's still unresolved. And I probably should have contacted you, and of all people, I didn't think of it. But I just want to say that I urge you to take a closer look. Maybe you need to look at the numbers. Maybe you're right. You get some, but not enough. I don't know if the trend is growing. And the last, and you probably wonder if there's a question here, and I guess there isn't. But the last comment I would have is that my business plan for any of those companies in the room would be to reverse their customer service and marketing budgets. Because I feel like that's where the money's being spent, and the folks representative are sort of stuck in the middle talking about these issues. But in my mind, the customer service, how did Representative Butler put it the other day? It vigorously inhales. So that's my two cents, and I think we got a problem, but you may very well have the tools at your disposal to help fix it.
Mr. Chair, we will be vigorous in pursuing that. And I'll leave a stack of my business cards.
Further questions from the committee? Thank you so much for being here to answer our questions. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 2672? Seeing none, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2672. And we will be opening a hearing on House Bill 2107. Sorry, three off. Give us a preview of 2107, please, Steve.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2107 requires construction contractor to notify construction contractor's board of certain judgments or arbitration awards against the contractor. There were -1 amendments when this was scheduled the last time, but the committee had just gotten them a couple hours before, so we decided to hold this bill over until the committee had a chance to review the amendments.
Thank you. And if we could get the appropriate folks, Craig Smith.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, before you should be -1 amendments to House Bill 2107. My name is Craig Smith. I'm with the Construction Contractors Board. This is a fairly simple bill at this point. It would require contractors who have court judgments and arbitration awards that have been converted to a court order to notify the Construction Contractors Board within 45 days if, in fact, the judgment has been left standing, unpaid for 30 days, and the judgment's not on appeal. The purpose of the legislation, frankly, is to encourage payment of judgments and also to put the Contractors Board on record as having received that judgment, and so that would allow us to take some action if, in fact, the judgment's not paid. Again, I think it's a fairly short bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Craig, first, could you just kind of go over what 2107-1 amendments do to this bill?
Okay. Chair Holvey, this is a bit of a rewrite by Legislative Council. The major thrust of the rewrite was to make sure that this only pertained to residential structures, residential construction work, and to limit it to court orders to take out arbitration awards to the extent that the arbitration awards weren't converted during the collections process by a court. It's somewhat unnecessary because if one is trying to collect an arbitration award, it needs to be verified by the court. So it is limited to court actions, and again, unpaid for 30 days and requires the contractor to notify Contractors Board within 45 days.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Girard.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. The question I have is, I think I've brought up the concern over the fact that there's no enforcement mechanism, so the bad apple's not going to report this anyway.
Right.
So I was kind of hoping to see that in the amendments. Can you tell me why that's not there?
Yeah. Chair Holvey and Representative Girard, Dash 1 amendments didn't address that, of course, at that time, and this is the same amendment that you saw before. The enforcement, of course, is that if one did not obey this, they'd be susceptible to both a $1,000 fine and suspension of their contractor's license. Now, how might we become aware of that? Well, we'd become aware that they didn't deliver it because usually the person who's owed the money comes to the Contractors Board screaming, saying, "What about this contractor? Why don't you do something?" Upon which we would know how old the judgment was, and we could take appropriate action.
Further questions from the committee? Looks like you're done. Thank you, Craig.
Thank you
for that. Is there anybody else that would wish to testify on House Bill 2107? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2107, open a work session on House Bill 2107. I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2107.
Representative Bonamici moves the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2107. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move that we pass House Bill 2107 with the Dash 1 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves House Bill 2107 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hannah, would you call the roll?
Representative
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative
Nelson. Aye. House Bill 2107, as amended, having received the required votes for passage, moves on to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Close the work session on House Bill 2107 and open a carrier. Do I have a volunteer to be a carrier? Okay. Representative Riley will carry House Bill 2107 to the floor. Thank you, Representative Riley. With that, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2224.
Steve, can you give us a preview of House Bill 2224?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2224 permits the Director of the Department of Business of Consumer and Business Services by rule to specify categories of insurance for which the Director need not review individual policy forms. If the Director finds the Interstate Insurance Product Regulation Commission or similar multi-state review process provides policyholders with the same protections or better than what are provided under state law.
Thank you. Department of Consumer and Business Services, do you wish to... Okay. Well, just Bill Sandler?
Sandler. It's you.
Thank you. If you could state your name for the record, that would be great, and give us your testimony.
You have my written testimony in front of you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Bill Sandu, and I'm a retired Rates and Forms analyst with more than 16 years of service with the Insurance Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services of the State of Oregon. After reviewing this legislation, I have some concerns regarding the benefits this legislation would provide to the Oregon insurance-buying public. With my experience regulating the Insurance Code of Oregon, I strongly believe that the Oregon insurance public's needs are best served if the insurance division keeps the authority and provided in the existing insurance statutes. During my time at the division, I received many calls from the insurance division in other states requesting copies of the Oregon insurance statutes so they could model their own after ours. They did this because our statutes were stronger and provided better coverage to the insurance buying public. I also have some questions regarding the insurance, Interstate Insurance Product Regulation Commission, which will have the authority to review certain policy forms listed in Section 5 of this legislation. Now, of course, now I understand it is going to be legislation by itself, not part of any section. What laws will regulate this commission? What legislative body will govern this commission? Did any of the Oregon legislatures had any input in the model compact developed by this commission? Did the Insurance Division of Oregon have any input into the development of the model compact? How will the commission compact be funded? Do they have enough funds to hire experienced rates and forms analysts who will review the forms for approval? I appreciate the opportunity to testify today and would be happy to take any questions from the panel.
Thank you. Questions from the committee. Representative Galizio.
Good afternoon, Mr. Sandu. Thank you for coming today.
Yes, sir.
What is your understanding of the motivation for this legislation?
From what I understand it, it would simplify the work of the insurance division because they would not have to review certain of these forms like life insurance, annuities, and disability forms, at least those three categories they have mentioned in the statute. But I still, because from my own experience, my view was the other states do not review the forms as good as Oregon did, and plus our laws, because I would review a form, policy form, and I would call the insurance company and tell them what I did not like in some of the form, even though it was in the law, but some of the things, provision they had put in the policy was not good for the Oregon buying public. And they would tell me, Mr. Sandu, you are the first one to object to any language in our policy. We have this policy approved in 25 states. Nobody objected because most of them were quite reading the way I was reading. I was reading from one page to another, every word of it. I can give you one small example if you would permit me. For example, the companies wanted to put a provision in their policy, health policy, that they would not pay for any surgery done over the weekends. And I would ask, why would you want to make a policy, a five-day policy, since it, why shouldn't it stay as a seven-day policy? And then they wanted to pay us, and they said, well, that's a good idea. I said, you can ask them to require, you can require an authorization to get your permission to get surgery on the weekend, but don't deny them surgery at all. And they were saying, well, that's reasonable, and they would put that in the policy. Then they wanted to penalize the insured, and they wanted to reduce the benefits almost to nothing. I said, well, they have paid the premium. I don't think you should reduce the benefit below the 50% level you would pay. They said, well, that's a good idea, and they would put that in. So I think it makes a difference how a person who is analyzing these forms, what kind of experience they have, and how concerned they are for the buying public. And I'm very proud of the dedication I had and people have had in this department, even now, that they wanted to serve the insurance buying public, and they work very hard. And I have a lot of respect for Mr. Joel Ariel, who is our administrator now, that he is also concerned in many, many ways that I've seen him over the years for the insurance buying public. But I still, my feeling is that insurance policy should be reviewed in Oregon for Oregon buying public and not from another state, which I have no idea. Like I have all these questions, I have no idea who is going to regulate, what laws will govern them, how would we know? I realize that insurance department has said in this law that we will review the policy, and if the policy complies with all the standards of Oregon, then they don't have to review. But you still got to review it then. If you don't review it, then you don't know what's in the policy. But even then, there can be things in the policy which I did not permit in Oregon, and people, I will not argue with them, I would reason with them, I would say, well, this is not a good provision in the policy, and they would generally take it out. So that's one of my concerns, is how well those policies will be reviewed far away from here, which will be sold in Oregon.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Chair, will Mr. Ariel have an opportunity to maybe address some of these questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Further questions from the committee? So, Mr. Sandler, before you step down, I'm curious. In this bill, I think that it states that it does still. I mean, I'm understanding that the Department of Consumer and Business Services still retains the authority to determine whether a particular policy provides the same or better protections. And so they still have that authority under this bill. So am I hearing you saying that even though that authority remains, that they're not going to review that?
Maybe Mr. Ariel can shed more light on, but my understanding is that if the policy is approved by the Interstate Commission, which is, I don't know where it's going to be located or who will control it or anything. And if we're going to review it, then what's the purpose of giving our authority away to somebody else? I don't quite see that. You know, if we're going to review the policy anyway to approve it, it would be better if we control the authority to review the policy in Oregon, not depend on somebody else to review it.
I think that answered my question.
Okay.
Yeah, I appreciate your testimony today. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, sir.
Next up, I have Mr. Ariel.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joel Ariel. I'm the Administrator of the Insurance Division with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I appreciate the opportunity to come after Bill, because I want to start by saying that he did do very, very good service for us for 16 years. I fully understand the motivation he brings here today. I think all of my staff, I would hope every one of them would say, I'm extremely proud of what I do. I believe we do it better than any other state in the country, and if we had to rely on other states, we wouldn't get done as well. I mean, that's the kind of pride I would like all of the staff to have. At the same time, the reality of insurance regulation, I think, is that in a lot of the areas that we regulate, because the same issues come up state by state, we do end up having to rely on each other across state lines to do a good job. And so my belief is probably if you talk to the regulators in California, you talk to the regulators in Florida, particularly if you talk to regulators in some of these bigger states but have much larger staffs, they would tell you that they comb these policies even more thoroughly than we do, because because the size of the state means that they might have three Bill Sandus for every one that we have. And so the issue is, can we get to a system where when we're doing the same kind of work in every state, that instead of everybody saying, I've got to do it myself because I don't trust any other states, that we can find a way to work together. And that's the concept behind the compact. But I want to be clear here that in no way, form, or shape does our advocacy for this concept mean that we think the people who do the current work in Oregon don't do a good job with it and don't do the very best job they can for consumers and so forth. It just means that the realities of the world are such that there ought to be more cooperation. Second thing I want to say in preparatory is we're not supporting the compact today, because the compact just got created in January, and I sent a letter to the committee just the other day explaining kind of what stages we're at, who's been elected as officers, what states are part of the compact, but the first product standards are still under review. So we aren't here today proposing, let's join this compact. 29 states have. What we're proposing today is essentially an experiment. Let us look at the compact as it develops. Let us look at each of the product standards as they're developed, and if they meet consumer protection, and I draw your attention on the dash one amendments to lines 13 and 14, if the commission's approval process taken as a whole gives policyholders, quote, substantially the same protection as or better protections than the approval process available under the laws of this state, and it lays out what that means, then we would approve things, we would rely on the compact in those cases. So that's what we're talking about in this bill. And I believe that does serve our mission of consumer protection. Our mission is to protect the insurance buying public, and if we look at the standards of the compact and determine they do as good a job as our standards for protecting the public, then I think it's a good thing that we rely on them, because as I've discussed with I think most members of the committee, we have other very, very important work to do in this area. And when we dedicate three full-time staff to looking through these policies, doing what Bill described on each policy, we don't do other things that we could do. I learned a while ago in my job that I'm going to have a hard time coming before the legislature and saying, instead of 90 staff next biennium, we need 120 staff or something. We've been around 90, 95 staff for the 10 years I've been part of the department. But we've reorganized ourselves many times to focus on the most important consumer protection issues of the day. Today, the most important issues in this area aren't these product review issues. They're important, but they're not the most important. The most important issues are the suitability issues. I've got an ongoing dialogue with one of your Senate colleagues on a product that he really wants in his portfolio, a variable annuity product. And it was recently approved. It had been disapproved previously, and it was looked at again and approved. But he wanted it in his portfolio because it worked for him. That product, I can tell you, would not work for an 85-year-old person who had a life expectancy of, say, 5 years or something. It just wouldn't. It wouldn't be a suitable product. Most of the issues we face today are not around which products should get into the market. They're around how are these products marketed. And I would love to take some of the resources we currently direct to this. If the compact shows itself to be good for consumers and then rely more on the compact, like we do on the financial side, we rely on every other state with its domestics, and then redirect those resources into suitability. So I come to you today to say this is good for consumers. Now, I know probably the issue that lurks for everybody here is it's also good for the insurance industry. So it does promote the second half of our mission, too, which is promote a positive business climate in the state. Once it serves consumers, that's my first task, got to serve consumers, then if it actually also helps the insurance industry, that's a good thing if it streamlines the process. So having them able not after they've gone through this compact where 29 states are combined and doing the review, then they have to come here and do it again. If it's good consumer protection, I think is a burden that's not necessary. So that's a second reason to support the bill. But I want to be clear that our primary purpose is to support consumers. And with that, I'll stop and be happy to take questions.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Ario, for being back. Are long-term care policies included? They're part of the compact, but will you have the ability under this bill to have long-term policies approved by the compact?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, no. The long-term care products are a set of products that we're not at this point confident about the compact on. These life annuity and disability products are the same state to state. The long-term care is more like, it's actually like the kind of products that Bill worked on. He did some work on these products, these life products, but he mostly worked on health products, which were unique to Oregon and which were easier to call up the Oregon companies and say, you got something in this policy I don't quite like, can we change it? That stuff happens more with those. So we picked the products that are the most off the shelf, so to speak, common across every state line, and long-term care is it's an evolving product, but we left it out because it raises a different set of issues that are more state-specific, I think, than the other products.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's my understanding, then, that anything that will be reviewed by the compact, they're virtually identical policies state to state, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, yes. I mean, when generalizing across thousands of policies, it's not true in every case, but in general terms, yes, that's true.
And would you give up the DCBS's ability or jurisdiction to review them if you had some doubt about the compact's position on a particular policy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, absolutely not. And that's why principal reason why we're not proposing the compact today, because we don't yet know enough about how the compact standards are going to be developed. I've been watching the process. I've been participating. I have a pretty good idea that it's going to work pretty well, but I don't know for certain how it's going to turn out. So therefore, we're not asking today to trust it. We're saying give us the authority that when it does develop this particular standards that we can look at it, and we absolutely won't give up our authority until we're convinced that the black and white words on the page are as good for consumers as our laws. I'll tell you, some of them are going to be better. Not all of them. Sometimes we're going to have an Oregon law. I doubt we will approve every price standard, because sometimes there will be something in Oregon that will say, gee, that's a better standard that put into the mix here makes the Oregon standards better. But in my experience, they're generally around the same almost all the time, and if there's differences, it cuts both ways. Sometimes we have better laws, sometimes the other states have better laws.
Thank you.
Representative Galizio.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand you're saying you're not endorsing the compact, but it's in the bill. So the person, if this gets through this committee and goes to the floor, the person who's carrying the bill might be asked about this compact and we'll have to respond that, well, this is in no way, shape, or form any kind of an endorsement of the compact. I don't want to be carrying this bill. I'll just tell you that much right now if it gets through, because it just would raise a lot of questions. Do you have Mr. Sandu's? Can you just answer the questions that he poses in a really concise format? Because I think he asks important questions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, yes, and Bill was kind enough to share it with me, and so I was scribbling some notes as he was speaking about these different questions. What laws will regulate this commission? The fundamental laws, like with all compacts, and there are hundreds of compacts, by the way, that Oregon has entered into and all states have, and the fundamental governing document for each of them, like this one, is the compact itself. So if Oregon were later on to adopt the compact, then this legislature would review the compact language and it would decide whether the governing document was appropriate. Today, the governing document is the compact that has been approved in the 29 states. So that is the governing law for the compact.
Which we don't endorse, which is not endorsed.
That's right. Mr. Chair, you don't, and Representative Guizzo, you don't have the compact in front of you because, but that is, for the 29 states that have done it, the legislatures in those states have looked at the language of the compact, it's about a 20-page bill, and endorsed that, and then that's the governing law of the compact. What legislative body? Again, it's the states who are members who govern it, and that was in the letter that I sent you earlier this week, which describes the 29 states, and then they appoint officers and a management committee, composed with my colleague to the north, Mike Kreidler, former member of Congress, is the representative from this local area to that board. By the way, he'd be a good example for you. When the compact first passed at the NEIC level before states did it, it was about a 2-to-1 vote for the compact, the same kind of discussion happened. He was probably the most passionate opponent of the compact as a former Democratic member of Congress, very concerned about consumer protection, said he didn't know how this was going to work. He then, 3 years later, because of how he's seen the standards develop, brought it to his legislature and got it passed, and now he's part of the compact governance structure. So the idea that who supports this compact is people who are sort of anti-consumer or something is just not true. Did any of the Oregon legislators have any input? I'm not sure. One group that has endorsed the compact is the National Conference of State Legislators, NCSL. Some members of the Oregon legislature I know are members of that. They may have participated in those discussions there. Did the insurance division have any input? Yes. I was quite active on this issue and putting together some of the issues, ensuring there was a consumer advisory board to match industry advisory board and so forth, other members of my staff. How will the compact be funded? Through filing fees? I don't think they've even decided exactly how that's going to work, but it's essentially the same funding that we have. All of our funding is dedicated funding by the users of our services, so in that sense, the insurance industry funds the insurance division, and the insurance industry would fund the compact in the same kind of way. Will they have enough funds to hire experienced rates and forms analysts? I don't know what Bill's asking price is now as a retired guy, but hopefully the answer to that will be yes. But again, those are the issues that are still developing. So that's why, I can't come here today and promise you that the compact will be the right engine. I believe more likely than not it will be, but that remains to be seen.
Thank you very much.
Further questions?
So I just want to make a comment, if I could, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I did notice that the endorsement by the NCSL is only the third time in the entire history of the NCSL that they endorsed this type of compact.
Mr. Chair, I have a comment.
Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Chair Holman. First of all, I wanted to follow Representative Guizzo, so I wasn't aware we could do this, but I too would like to be exempt from carrying this bill. But I want to point out...
I'm just making it was a hope. Yeah. It was not a...
Can I share
whatever the
hope.
Chair wants?
I share Representative Guizzo. And just remind him that of a term that may or may not jog your memory, that I don't know if Joel likes, but he was describing this the last time as compact light. And I thought he did a credible job of showing how this would be a reasonable path, because I had the same concerns you did, but I felt like he was saying it's good, but we're not committing it. So rather than it sounding like we're on the fence, I think it demonstrates a cautionary approach to this, which is why I'm for it and not caring. So
you could say that louder if you'd like.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gerard.
I like to comment that that's what the consent agenda is all about.
Yeah, I can see this one getting pulled out pretty easily.
I misread this, Mr. Chair, and I apologize.
Any further questions from the committee?
I just want to follow up with one question myself, and that was a point that I'm still, I guess, a little foggy on, and I apologize. I think if I had this discussion with you previously, and that is the fact that you know, given a, I guess, the hypothetical scenario that we, the, this compact is reviewing our insurance product, and you're making a determination that that product is better to or equal to or better than, you know, the products that we would approve anyway. I mean, it kind of seems like we're reviewing it anyway. So we're having them review it, and then you're reviewing them reviewing it. And so, I mean, is that just something that's being initially done until you're comfortable the compact's doing a good job, and then you stop reviewing what they approve? Or exactly how does that, how do you determine that, that it's a better, it provides better protections or equal protections that the state does?
Mr. Chair, very good questions. That I didn't bring my stack of paper today that I'd shared with a lot of you of how much work it is to go through and look at all the compact standards on a product and then look at all of our standards and then determine whether their standards are as good as our standards. And we would have to go through that work on each category of product. Once we did that review, though, if we determined their standards were as good or better than ours, then we would not repeat that on every single new filing that came in. We would have decided for that category, the compact has good standards, has a good review process, protects citizens properly. And so when each individual filing came in, if it had been approved by the compact, we would not have to duplicate that process one by one. So we'd be reducing our work to doing it once for a category rather than doing it on each individual filing. In some of these categories, there might be more than 1,000 individual filings in any given year. So that's where the savings come in. Now, that raises another question, which kind of Bill alluded to, which is, well, what happens if somebody kind of slips through the compact on an individual basis that wasn't really appropriate, didn't fit their standards, or something like that? That does happen. I mean, we all the time in consumer complaints have cases where somebody's complaining to us about a contract and it's got some term in it that we look at and say, gee, what is this term? And then go back to rates and forms. And sometimes we find out that they didn't approve it, so the company's using it on an unapproved form, and then they're penalized for that. I signed an order on one of those today for using unapproved form. Sometimes, because these guys read thousands of policies, we find out that what they're using was actually approved, but it didn't meet our standards, and so the approval wasn't a correct approval under the statutes, and in those cases we can still go back when it comes up and say, just because somebody happened to miss that in the review process doesn't mean it changes the standard, so you still are using something that doesn't conform to the product standards. And sometimes those cases go to court, and sometimes the courts tell us that we don't care that you approved it, we don't think it meets the law anyway, and we're going to overturn it. So just the fact that it's been approved through a process, if it turns out to not be an appropriate product and not comply with consumer protection standards, it can be undone and is regularly undone, you know, on a case-by-case basis when an issue comes up.
Yeah, and I thank you for that. That, I guess, refreshes my memory on this topic. Another question, though, perhaps, is once the state of Oregon actually decided to join this compact, I guess since the contract to enter into the compact is, you know, controlled by the compact, it really isn't regulated by any other government entity, could we just unjoin that compact at some point in the future if the state of Oregon decided that we didn't want to participate in this compact anymore? We could just leave it?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. Now, as everybody up there well knows, the way to do that would be simply to pass the law that withdrew from the compact. So, yes, it's as easy to undo it by legislative act as it is to join it by legislative act, but in fairness, people will point out that once you pass the law, it's harder to undo the law than it is to pass, you know, it's harder to pass things in the building than it is to stop things. So, but the answer is absolutely yes. And any time the legislature wanted to, they would be able to pass a law to undo the compact. And there's even provision today in the compact. I believe, I haven't been as expert on the compact details lately because we're not joining it now, but I believe there's language in there that allows a legislature to say, we're withdrawing from this product or that product, to selectively pull out of various things. And there's even, I think, ability for administrative agencies with a higher standard to withdraw from particular aspects of the compact. The compact itself was worked out over a long period of time, and Representative Bonamici is absolutely right. Some of the national associations that aren't want to cooperate in these kind of ways, in ways that do have states sharing authority, supported this, like NCSL. And so there are a lot of provisions in there that create some flexibility back for states. And if we got into the compact as an entity, I think the important point, I think in a conversation with Representative Riley, is this really a four-year experiment? We're going to look at this, and then in 4 years, before this body would ever have to decide, and we may never even propose it, but if it was proposed again in 4 years, you would be able to say, well, gee, what happened over these 4 years? How many of those standards did you adopt, and which ones did you not adopt, and why did you not adopt some of them and others? There'd be a rich body of knowledge to put you in a much better position. I don't want to say that the 29 states that have already joined didn't give it careful consideration, but you would be able in this body to give it a more thorough consideration, because you would have had this compact light version to look at what happened under it for 4 years.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Mr. Aereo? Thank you, Mr. Aereo, for your comments. Is there anybody else that wishes to provide testimony on House Bill 2224? If not, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2224. At this point, I think we are going to adjourn this committee on the House Committee on Consumer Protection. Thank you very much for attending today and providing us your testimony.